Hey, this is Peter Biello, host of the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. Programs like this one are really important. They help us reflect on the week's news, which moves so quickly these days. And support from people like you help keep it going. So if you use this podcast, please consider making a contribution that works for your budget. $10, $20, whatever works for you. We just ask that you give now at nhpr.org or follow the link for the show notes. And thank you very much for supporting NHPR. All right, here's the show.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And by Antioch University New England, offering doctoral degrees in clinical psychology, environmental studies, and marriage and family therapy, as well as master's degrees and certificates. antioch.edu/nhradio.
And from Dartmouth-Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. After Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy announces his retirement, New Hampshire senators call for a moderate nominee to replace him. The High Court deals a blow to public sector unions to the delight of Governor Chris Sununu and other supporters of right-to-work policies. And the chair of the state GOP, Jeanie Forrester, abruptly resigns. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we will talk about them in this hour. You can call into the Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And we're also streaming a live video of this radio show, and you can check out the stream at our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, political reporter Paul Steinhauser, and Jeff Feingold of New Hampshire Business Review. Thank you very much, everybody, for being here.
Great to be here.
Hi, Peter.
Again, listeners, phone number for you to call to join the conversation, 1-800-892-6477. We have a lot of news to discuss pertaining to the Supreme Court this week. The big news, obviously, Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy announced his retirement, and quickly, Senator Gene Shaheen and Senator Maggie Hassan spoke about the kind of Supreme Court justice they want, not a conservative, more of a moderate. Yes, Paul, is that what they're looking for?
Yeah, they're both talked about the next nominee should be somebody who could get about 60 votes in the Senate, which is what the old threshold was before the filibuster was gotten rid of. Yeah, they're looking for more of a mainstream candidate that could appeal to both Republicans and even some Democrats. That's what they and a lot of Democrats said. And I spoke to Shaheen yesterday for a story that's coming out in the Concord Monitor this week, and she also urged Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, the top Republican, to set a clear rule for consideration of Supreme Court nominees, and he should stick to it. What she's saying is, remember back in 2016 when the Republicans said no way to President Obama's nominee, we have to wait until the people speak in the November presidential election. Now she and other Democrats are saying, well, the same thing should apply this time around. It should wait until after the midterm elections. That's not flying with the Republicans, though.
Yeah, Mitch McConnell saying, well, midterms are different.
Exactly.
Yeah. So would they and other Democrats, even with the new threshold, be able to hold up the new nominee if they don't like this new nominee?
It's going to be really tough. Remember, the Republicans have a 51-49 majority in the U.S. Senate. There are two Republicans who may waver on this. They're both women. They're both supporters of abortion rights. Collins of Maine, Murkowski of Alaska. Even if the Republicans lose those two, remember, there's about three or four conservative Democrats up for re-election this year in states that Trump overwhelmingly won. Three of them actually voted for Neil Gorsuch last year. So the math is not really good for the Democrats here.
And they said there'll be a vote in November, the Senate.
They hope to do it before November. They'd actually like to get the justice on the court by the beginning of October when the next Supreme Court session begins.
That's moving quickly, Jeff.
First Monday in October. And the other thing I have to say is that the initial feeling among the Democrats, I guess, was that what they wanted to do was make a big issue out of this, comparing this to 2016. You know, basically, it's not fair. You held up an election. You held up a nomination until after an election. They were going to try to make a big deal out of it, but apparently they realized that that's not going to really sell. But I think in the what they're going to try to do, and I think you've seen this with Senators Shaheen and Hassan, is make a really big issue about things like abortion rights. That is going to be they're hoping that that energizes their base, that really gets them going to get into the polls in November, and hope that somehow the pressure on certainly on Senator Collins, I think that she's like primo in the targets of them. It's like if you really do, and she is pro-choice. Say, if you really believe that, you're going to have to really stick up for your beliefs on this.
And I think both parties are hopeful that this will be an issue around which they can mobilize their core partisan supporters for the election. Republicans will argue that if you liked Judge Gorsuch, you need to get out and vote in the midterm election, because if the balance changes in the Senate, that's going to be problematic for future conservative justices. And certainly Democrats want to be out there arguing that a more solid 5-4 conservative majority on the court could spell doom for Roe v. Wade and LGBT rights and affirmative action. The thing to remember with Anthony Kennedy, and I heard somebody on TV made kind of an interesting, obvious point. In what other profession would you ask somebody who's 82, why do you have to retire right now? I mean, you got to be realistic about this. This is his time to do it. He is a conservative. If you remember way back 30 years ago, Robert Bork wasn't able to get confirmed. Then they brought in Douglas Ginsburg, who's kind of been lost to history. But he actually had tried marijuana, which was enough to disqualify you back there. My students can't believe that, but that was enough to disqualify you back 30 years ago. And that's how we ended up with Anthony Kennedy. He's a conservative. He is a swing vote, but he's not kind of a wildly unpredictable swing vote. But he has been kind of a sort of a moderate limitation on some core areas like gay marriage, gay rights discrimination, abortion rights. So that's the concern, that a more solid conservative majority would kind of take some of those filters or limits off of some of these social policies.
Yeah, apparently there was some reporting in the New York Times today that said that basically there was pressure from the White House, you know, not subtle pressure to Justice Kennedy of saying, maybe if you're thinking of retiring, we know we're going to make sure that we cement your legacy, and we're going to find someone who's going to be as great as you are and all that stuff. So there was this behind the scenes effort to kind of convince him, it'll be safe for you to step down, that kind of thing. And as Dean said, he is a very conservative on a lot of issues. The only issues that he's not are the social issues that I think really are vulnerable even when he was there, but they're more vulnerable now, potentially much more vulnerable with an appointee that who's as conservative as Justice Kennedy on economic issues, but also on social issues. It's almost a given that there's going to be some really radical changes to our life.
Yeah. Well, there was even on Morning Edition this morning, we heard from folks who were saying that they've been waiting for an opportunity to overturn Roe v. Wade. Is that a real threat here if we get the right person on the court?
Well, Paul? That's a great question to bring it home to New Hampshire here. How does this news impact us? And Dean and Jeff made a good point. This is energizing the bases on both sides. But if Roe v. Wade is overturned, perchance, who knows what will happen? It comes back to the states,
yeah.
Remember? And, well, Molly Kelly yesterday, she's one of the two Democrats running for governor. What does a gubernatorial race have to do at all with the Supreme Court? She's now making the point, as she tries to energize her base, to say that, well, it will come down to the states if it's overturned.
Right. The issue is that states will be able to pass increasingly restrictive abortion laws that will then no longer risk being overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court, that there's be a lot of these states that are already moving in that direction will be able to do so even further with impunity.
What happens, like states like New Hampshire, which I think would be kind of difficult in the state the way things are today to pass more restrictive abortion laws, but there are many other states, especially in the Midwest and the South, that have tried very hard to be restrictive, and then they would be able to just say no abortions within our borders.
So for the first time since the 2012 election cycle, we in New Hampshire do not have a high-profile Senate battle. We had some doozies in 2014 and 16. So why will this story impact our elections? It will. It'll be a big issue in almost every election. The two congressionals, the gubernatorials we just talked about, even battles for the state house. It's almost going to be a litmus test now for a candidate on either side. Where do you stand on the Supreme Court? Even if you're running, maybe even for state rep.
Yeah. Yep. Well, this is just the beginning of the debate on who's going to fill that seat. We're going to be covering this for months to come. But let's talk about another SCOTUS decision that came out this week. The Supreme Court also ruled that public sector unions can't compel the non-union employees to pay dues. The majority wrote that this was a matter of free speech. Justice Sonia Sotomayor, in her dissent, said that this was a weaponization of the First Amendment. How might this decision impact unions here in New Hampshire? Dean?
Well, the issue is for public sector employees, and we've already seen the state attorney general, Governor Sununu, I believe, signed an order, actually was able to read it online, that said that starting, I think, literally with the next pay period, that if you are a public sector employee but you're not a member of a union, you can no longer be charged agency or fair share fees to cover union collective bargaining, even if you're covered by that collective bargaining. So it's going to have an immediate impact for public sector union employees. And we've had these right-to-work debates in the state for a long time. It's been difficult to do legislatively. It's been attempted sometimes successfully in other states. And this really kind of settles the issue in some sense in a very direct way. Certainly for public employees, it doesn't cover private unions.
Right. Paul?
Yeah, you know, Dean made a good point. Remember, we had a huge battle just last year over the right-to-work legislation. Republican governor, Republican legislature, and they still could not get it passed. This makes it moot now. It is passed, right, thanks to the Supreme Court. I spoke to the head of the Service Employees Union. It's the largest labor union in this state, and, yeah, they're going to be affected. They're not happy about this ruling, but they also think that it'll energize their workers, their rank and file, to get out and try to do something about it in the November elections.
And we spoke earlier this week with Rich Gullah, president of the State Employees Association, which represents roughly 10,000 members.
I think it's a blow to the middle class, and I think it's a long-standing agenda to divide working people and rig the economy in favor of moneyed interest groups.
And we also heard from Greg Moore with Americans for Prosperity, a supporter of right-to-work bills in the state. He, in contrast to Rich Gullah, was pretty happy about the Supreme Court's decision.
All individuals, whether they're working for the government or not, it helps expand all of our free speech rights and free association rights.
So they're setting up the conflict here. Is this a blow to the middle class or a victory for free speech? Or maybe, depending on how you view things, just both. Jeff?
Well, I know certainly it's a blow to the unions, and that's going to be difficult. But I think that they saw this thing coming, because there's been previous rulings in the Supreme Court that signaled that they were going to be amenable to this kind of thing. And, you know, this is one of the examples where Justice Kennedy showed how conservative he was, I guess. And the other thing is that really it's – the bottom line is I do think that the public employees unions were prepared for this, but I don't think that means that they were actually going to be able to react as they still can't control the reaction. I mean, what's going to happen to their members? There's been polls that show that there'll be several – you know, up to a fifth or even more of their members would just say, "Well, we're done. I'm not going to pay dues anymore." And maybe a quarter, about a third or so, they say, well, "No, I'm going to be a union member. I'm sticking with it." But there's that big middle there that they don't know, and that could really affect their ability to exist in some ways.
Paul,
I'm a campaign reporter. There is a big political impact here, and here it is. Who are the biggest supporters of the Democrats, right? Labor unions. So this weakens the labor unions. It may weaken their support, or at least the financial support they can give to Democratic candidates. That's the political impact we may see as early as this November's election.
And will the public sector unions, now that this is this decision has been made, just have to make a better case to people who are working there? Like, okay, now you're not compelled to, but really, here are the reasons why you should become a member of
the union. Right, and Jeff has been talking about that. They've seen it coming, as you've said, and they're trying to adapt.
Yeah, that is the message that they've been trying to send, and I think it's going to be even stronger now.
Mm-hmm. This is the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. And coming up, the Supreme Court upholds President Trump's ban on travel for people from several countries. What do you think of this ban and of the Supreme Court's decision? Do you work with refugees from these countries, or do you know someone who is hoping to come to America from one of these countries? Even if not, share your thoughts on this. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You can also send your thoughts by email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. We'll move on to yet another Supreme Court decision that was made this week regarding sales tax. This may require retailers here in New Hampshire to change the way they do business. And Governor Sununu is not happy about this at all. And he was pledging that New Hampshire will not go quietly about this.
If you try to come into our state, force our businesses to collect their sales tax, you're going to have the fight of your life.
And Governor Sununu is calling for a special legislative session to pass a bill that would establish legal and procedural roadblocks to prevent other states from collecting sales tax from New Hampshire businesses.
Put simply, the legislation will erect every possible legal and procedural hurdle to prevent other states from forcing our businesses to collect sales taxes.
So the governor seems to lay it out there pretty clearly. Dean, are there any nuances that the governor is leaving out there? Or
well, I think people are waiting to see, in some sense, you mentioned what he has in mind for the special session. I think part of it depends on what the actual legislation is. But the reality is, given, the Supreme Court decision, the legislative action is subject to judicial review. And this could, they could pass legislation. We could very well end up back in court on this. But I mean, obviously, given how central the no sales tax is, the no income tax to a lot of political careers in the state, he has to really make a strong stand on this. But again, this stuff will be subject to judicial review and could end up back in court.
This is a bipartisan issue in New Hampshire, as far as I can tell. Everybody seems to be lining up against this ruling and in support of New Hampshire businesses that do business online. But the interesting thing is that for many years, and I've been covering the retail industry for all these years in New Hampshire, and ever since the beginning of Amazon, and as it became this gigantic monolith, what's happened is that a lot of brick and mortar retailers have been complaining about the advantage that online retailers have over them. They have a discount, an automatic discount, of not having to collect sales tax. They're in a bad situation as opposed, I'm talking about retailers outside of New Hampshire, obviously.
And on top of that, President Trump has been very critical of Amazon.
Exactly.
President Trump said this.
He actually praised this ruling. He said it's about time. He basically said this is something that needs to be done. I don't know how much of it has to do with the nuances of internet sales tax as opposed to the Amazon existence. Yeah.
Paul?
Let me bring it back to politics again, campaign politics.
Guess what?
We got those elections coming up in 4 months. Who's up for re-election? Governor Chris Sununu. So there's a reason here, a lot of reasons he's doing this, but one is, this is a popular issue. It plays well with his base, but it also plays well with those motor voters in the middle. We have a lot of independent or undeclared voters here. He is now the defender of the live free or die spirit. It's a smart political move.
I'm always amazed, just as an aside, having lived in the state for about 25 years now, how many people I know who, even though there are some Democrats progressives who want an income tax or we need to change the tax base. Mm-hmm. We hear that argument. I'm always amazed at how many people who move here from elsewhere and very quickly become staunch defenders of no sales, no income tax. They really change their tune once they've spent several years living in the state. And so this is a big issue for both parties.
We got a series of questions from Mary in Nashua. I don't know if anybody here can answer them, but I'd like to ask because they are interesting questions. So first of all, when does this go into effect? Is this immediate?
I think somewhere like 30 to 90 days.
30 to 90 days.
And states already have, many states, like South Dakota, which was the plaintiff in this case, they have already set up rules for this.
Okay. And do New Hampshire people selling goods in other states have to collect sales tax? Or I guess will they have to starting in 30 to 60 days?
Yeah, well, according to this, if South Dakota, for example, if someone in South Dakota buys something from a retailer in New Hampshire, and actually Grand State Candy was there at the press conference with the governor, they bought something from Grand State Candy. Apparently what would happen is that Grand State Candy would have to pay South Dakota the sales tax, or collect the sales tax on this person in South Dakota
and give
it back to South Dakota.
Wow, okay. Does it affect individuals like you or me selling stuff on eBay or Etsy?
Well, that remains to be seen. It probably will affect Etsy and eBay, but they've been trying really hard. There are thresholds in the South Dakota law that says basically if you have 200 or fewer sales, you don't have to collect the tax, or $100,000. So it probably, if you're just an occasional person on Etsy or eBay, you don't have to worry about it.
Okay. And does the ruling apply to services rendered from people in New Hampshire to people or organizations in other states, or is it just physical items?
That's a very good question, because many states do have taxes on that, and I'm not clear on. I would think that I just I'm not a lawyer. I don't play one on TV or anything, but I'm thinking it sounds like, you know, why not? It's a tax is a tax.
Yeah, well, we really got down in the weeds thanks to Mary and Nashua, but those are good questions, so thank you very much. Appreciate that.
And here's one question Mary didn't ask, but it's also, what's the timetable for this special session? Well, a week and a half from now, the executive council meets. They'll have to approve this. That'll likely happen. It'll be a shocker if it doesn't. And then lawmakers will probably meet in the autumn.
Okay. One last thing to talk about before the break regarding the Supreme Court. And that's that the High Court upheld President Trump's ban on travel for people from some countries, Muslim majority countries, some of them. What was the reaction here in New Hampshire? Dean?
Pretty predictable along party lines. You know, we've been dealing with this issue really since the beginning of the Trump presidency. And I believe this is the third iteration of the travel ban. I think it's actually, in a sense, been in effect since December in reality. But so, you know, pretty much you would expect this is very quickly this and the right to work decision, the union fee decision, and another decision on information about abortion services. All three of those and Anthony Kennedy's retirement all hit boom, boom, boom right in a row. So it's quite a week for conservatives. But that issue, the travel ban issue, which is kind of one of the earliest issues for Trump, has really kind of been folded into this and also the refugee crisis. But it's pretty predictable reaction at this point.
Okay. And we've got a call from John in Concord. John, thank you very much for calling. What's your question or comment?
My comment is on the travel ban. It's just that there's, 50 Muslim countries, and we're only targeting a few that we're currently at war with, whether it's declared or not declared war. And, that's it.
So you're in support of the travel ban is what you're saying?
Yeah, I am. I think it probably should represent a few more countries, especially those that, you know, are possibly hostile, like Somalia. I don't know if you've seen Black Hawk Down, but that's a pretty scary place.
Mm-hmm. It's been well documented, John, that there are pretty strict vetting requirements for people coming not just from these countries but from others. Is it your opinion that these vetting processes procedures aren't good enough to prevent any threat?
Yeah, I think so. I have some friends that they have some of the Nigerians moved in next to them, and you know they're just scared to death of them. And yeah, I don't know.
All right, John. Thanks very much. You know, it struck me with respect to this. This decision and reading the decision based on the Supreme the legal authority the president has, A, that you know, elections really do matter, and B, this is not a judgment on policy, right?
Mm-hmm. The decision was just really about whether or not the president, what kind of power he has in terms of controlling who comes into the country, the borders, and how absolute that power is. And, you know, if you were listening carefully to some of the top legal scholars in the country over the last year or so, they all predicted that this is where we would end up. The political issue aside, they all predicted that the president has wide latitude in deciding who comes in and out of the country. So in that sense, it's not a surprise.
Yeah. Well, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. We're speaking with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website NH Political Capital, political reporter Paul Steinhauser and Jeff Feingold of New Hampshire Business Review, and with you. We're going to be talking about protests regarding a family separation for immigrants at the border and the governor's reaction to it. Also, tariffs. That's coming up after the break. So give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org or post on a Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, which is where you can watch a live video of this radio show. We'll be right back. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with Jeff Feingold of New Hampshire Business Review, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and author of the website NH Political Capital, and political reporter Paul Steinhauser. Give us a call if you have questions or comments about the week's news. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And we want to let you know about a conversation scheduled for Monday's program. It's part of our Race for the First series. Host Laura Kanoy is sitting down with candidates running in New Hampshire's 1st Congressional District. And Monday, we're speaking with Republican Bruce Crochetier. What questions do you have for him? Send them now to exchange@nhpr.org. And you can listen back to all the interviews in our Race for the First series at nhpr.org or subscribe to the podcast of The Exchange wherever you get your podcasts. So we'll start this section of the program talking about family separation. Protesters gathered this week in New Hampshire to demonstrate opposition to the policy that separated parents from their children at the border. That policy officially ended at the time of a big protest in Dover. But what were protesters saying at this point? This was Wednesday of this week. Dean?
Yeah, it was, opposition to the separation. And, you know, the concern was that even though President Trump signed the executive order to stop it and to reunite the families, that in practice, it's just a very complicated thing to do. There's prior case law that could, in theory, complicate that. There was some anecdotal evidence that children were still arriving at shelters provided by Health and Human Services, whereas you'd expect the number to be going the other direction as people are reunited. Some suggestion that some kids may never be reunited with their parents. So there's plenty. If you're opposed to this policy, as it seems like the vast majority of Americans are, there was plenty to continue to protest just in terms of the administration's ability to deal with the mess that was created by the by the zero tolerance policy.
Yeah, it just seemed that it was a decision that was made to separate these children, and I've understood is that there really was no attempt to even say, well, we're taking this child from you, but we'll know that this is your child, and we'll be able to return you. We're going to keep track of you and keep track of your child. But the numbers, according to the Homeland Security, were not that high that they couldn't be able to keep track of these children. But
a couple of thousand,
and it's still a little unnerving to think that they would separate children from their parents and not be able to keep track of them.
Mm-hmm. What has the governor said about this policy?
Well, he's basically said that he doesn't support this policy of separating families. It's as Dean said, it's a pretty overwhelming antagonism toward it, but the governor is trying to have it both ways, by saying he supports this policy in general of securing the borders and all that.
It's a tough situation for Governor Sununu because once again he's a Republican. He's a supporter of Donald Trump, right? So this puts him, he has to walk on a high wire here, I guess you could say. And he was very clear when we started asking him about a week and a half ago, reporters from NHPR as well. And he said that no, he would not send the National Guard troops here in New Hampshire down to the border to help separate families. But he also pointed out that New Hampshire has not been asked to do that. So, again, it's a tough situation for him. And there's also another angle here that ties it to New Hampshire. Our own Congresswoman, one of our two, Annie Custer, in the 2nd District, went down. She was one of 24 Democratic members of Congress that went down this past weekend to visit one of those detention centers. And she told me that she was distressed. She said it was a heart-wrenching situation. It was a heartbreaking experience. I know you guys spoke to her as well.
And what can Congress do? Anything?
They can. They can take action to force the Department of Homeland Security to change their rules. Gene Shaheen, our senior U.S. senator, has called for the Secretary of Homeland Security to resign unless the Trump administration gets a plan in place. That's all been superseded, I think, now by the Supreme Court. Or no, was it an
appeals
court?
It was a court decision. It was not Supreme Court, but it was a court decision that ordered, I think, 30 days maximum.
Yeah. Right.
But now I believe the Trump administration has said that needs to be vacated because on national security. Security grounds. So you are getting pushback from the administration about having a court set a timeline on when this needs to be done.
And really, if you judge the past performance of the of Congress, that nothing's going to get done on this. I could safely predict that they're just going to dance around the edges. They got that House has a certain belief on this issue. The Senate is much more closely divided. And I can't see any common ground on this. It's a very difficult environment right now.
They've shown an unwillingness to approach this either through comprehensive immigration reform, because then that gets bogged down with funding the wall and a path to citizenship, or to peel off specific issues like DACA or the separation policy and just vote on that. So it's just they're really stuck in a sense. We've had two attempts at immigration bills in the House, and they've both been defeated.
Yeah, just since last week, and that's why I'm saying there's not going to be a legislative solution with this current Congress the way it's made up.
Paul?
And let me bring it again back to politics. We're in a midterm election season. This was a humongous political story and will continue to be. It's obviously unifying Democrats and energizing them even further. In a way, it's dividing Republicans, because a lot of Republicans, it's bad optics. These children separated from their parents, horrible optics. Whether you want wants to build the wall or not, this was not a good visual. So it has divided Republicans. Here in this state, you know, we have these checkpoints here in New Hampshire. I know we'll talk about that more, but even the gubernatorial candidates played off this. Steve Marchand, I think we'll talk about this more, had a whole sanctuary state event this week. Molly Kelly on Saturday is going to be marching in one of these protest marches, gatherings here in the state of New Hampshire.
And interestingly enough, Vermont Senator Pat Leahy is introducing legislation to scale back these checkpoints. You know, we know that the Border Patrol has added flexibility and jurisdiction 100 miles from the border, and Leahy wants legislation to scale back that those stepped-up roadblocks and checks.
And we will talk about Steve Marchand's plan to make New Hampshire a sanctuary state in just a few minutes. But I want to give listeners some time to give us a call about this idea. The sanctuary state idea, by the way, under Marchand's plan, local law enforcement would not be allowed to ask someone about their immigration status or detain them solely because of their status. They would not assist federal immigration officials in arrests based on civil immigration warrants, and they would not hold someone in jail past their release date at ICE's request. What do you think about this? Please give us a call. Let us know. 1-800-892-6477 or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Give us a call now so we can bring you into that part of the conversation when it starts. I want to ask one more question about the governor's response to something the Trump administration has done. And that is the governor's expressed displeasure with the Trump administration's imposition of tariffs, especially when it comes to Canada. Jeff, what's the governor's position here?
Well, basically, the governor is just criticizing these tariffs that were imposed on aluminum and steel, on aluminum and steel from various countries, but specifically Canada. But it's also affected New Hampshire manufacturers, and I think he's starting to hear that. Actually, we've done reporting on this for the last couple of months. These tariffs have already had an effect, even though they had an effect even before they went into effect, because suppliers in the United States who have the similar products have already raised their prices by about 25%. So you have companies that need steel and aluminum have not been able to get it at the prices they had before, and many of them, smaller manufacturers in New Hampshire. They're afraid they won't be able to pass on that price increase to their customers, or at least not the whole thing. So it's already had an effect. I'm sure that that people have been discussing this with the governor and with other people at Business and Economic Affairs Department. And this is something that he and other governors have spoken out about. It's obvious at this point that the White House is not going to back down on this thing. And the concern is that the longer this plays out, the more of a negative effect it's going to have on the New Hampshire economy in particular and the U.S. economy in general.
Paul, bring it back to the political angle.
Here I go. just like the Supreme Court decision on the internet sales tax, it unifies Democrats and Republicans here in this state. This is something they definitely agree on. So, and it also gives the governor a chance to separate himself, distance himself a little bit from President Trump.
Yeah, and one report I saw, this may unite beer drinkers at least, is that the price of aluminum for cans is going to go up.
Absolutely.
Will beer drinkers want to pay 25% more? I don't know. Do beer drinkers vote? We'll see.
They do. Well, I'm a beer drinker. I vote.
Okay. And if you order it online, you have to pay the sales tax.
Oh, jeez.
Double whammy.
Wow.
That sounds like a bumper sticker, Paul. I'm a beer drinker and I vote. Okay, we got to get serious here. We have another story to talk about. We learned late last week that state GOP chair Jeanie Forrester resigned from her position. Apparently it was to take a job that would take up so much of her time. Right, Paul?
That was
ostensibly
that's what she said. Listen, this was a shocker, and it came abruptly late on a Friday afternoon, right? When you try to bury news, she gave nobody a heads up other than the governor. He got a 1 hour heads up. The governor who put her in place.
Hmm.
There's two reasons, I think, why she was frustrated. What is the main job of a state party chair? To raise money. Well, Jeanie Forrester was never really that good at raising money as a state senator or when she ran for governor in 2016. And the state party last week, we saw the numbers. They trailed vastly behind the New Hampshire Democratic Party when it comes to money. I think she was frustrated. She wasn't getting a lot of help from the governor, who's busy with his own reelection campaign raising money. She wasn't getting a lot of support elsewhere. The other big job for a state party chair, to win elections. elections. Well, the Democrats have actually won most of the special elections over the last 16 months in this state. I think she was frustrated. She wasn't getting the help. And she said, I'm out of here. It comes at a bad time for the Republicans because, again, those midterm elections are just over 4 months away.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say it's interesting to see a Republican party chair leave the position when you have a Republican governor and a Republican state legislature. I mean, it kind of sort of gives you a sense of what's going on underneath the surface. And in some sense, that Republican party chair has always been a little bit of a thankless job. The Democrats, it's much more professionalized. They have a bigger infrastructure. You raise a lot more money. I mean, the numbers really were, it was like tenfold, I think. Something
10-1.
10-1. It was remarkable. Yeah. You can't have that.
Not to sound like an old fart, but I'll do it anyway. But this is remarkable when I think about the shape the Democratic Party was in the 80s and 90s, early 90s, and it really has been quite a turnaround, and it's just reversed the roles actually, because back in the day the Democrats could barely get two nickels together, and they have a much more as Dean said, a much more vibrant network. They're doing much better at just being more professional than the Republicans, which is shocking to me when I think about that.
And they have a pretty strong, you know, my sense is they have a pretty strong young up and coming bench as well. Young Democrats seem to be everywhere all the time.
Exactly.
And that's a good way to build the party long term.
Well, it seems like people were saying kind things about Jeanne Forrester. Even Ray Buckley of the Democratic, the state Democratic Party, was saying, "I know what it's like to be in this role.
Well,
it's tough."
He did.
So
he bashed her for the last year and a half. But now
know,
that she's gone,
yeah.
Hey, that's true. It is a thankless job.
Well, that's one of the reasons why people have are skeptical about politics.
No, don't say that.
They attack you when you're in power, and then when you leave, you're the best. You're the best ever. One other story to talk about. Actually, there are several, but we'll talk about this one. A group of seven Republican state representatives is challenging the nonprofit status of the conservative policy group Americans for Prosperity. Why are they doing that, Dean?
Well, it's interesting. So you have these seven. It's a little surprising that it's actually Republican lawmakers who have asked state attorney general to look into whether or not Americans for Prosperity is a conservative advocacy group, particularly on financial matters, asking the state AG to see if they should register as a political committee rather than as a nonprofit, because these particular seven Republican lawmakers opposed right to work, something we were talking about earlier in the show. And so they were targeted with mailers by AFP, and that's the essence of the issue here, is in targeting individual legislators. Are you in some sense should you lose your nonprofit status?
But the irony is that after this ruling of the Supreme Court, I mean, is right to work, you know, what's the issue that we're talking about right now? So I'm kind of curious to see where this does lead. And what's the Americans for Prosperity? I've noticed they've been focusing a lot on energy lately, and that's probably their next domain.
Remember, this is the state chapter of the national organization that's been funded by the Koch brothers. This has been at the hit list or targeted by Democrats for years. The state director here, very effective, Greg Moore. And I think he's angered, though, other Republicans who don't always agree with what he's advocating for. And I'll just say one other thing. Remember, this is the former state director before Greg Moore was Corey Lewandowski. We all know him.
Thank you for the context. I did not know that, Paul. Thank you very much. Let's talk about another story this week. An intern working for Senator Maggie Hassan shouted an expletive at the president this week. The senator reprimanded the intern but did not fire her, and that was grounds for criticism of Senator Maggie Hassan. And the GOP put out a fundraising ad pretty quickly about this.
If that's the way Senator Hassan runs her office, she's letting down the people of New Hampshire.
Senator Hassan needs to do the right thing. She needs to fire the intern and stop the culture of hate.
According to this ad, it is Senator Hassan's responsibility to stop the culture of hate. Jeff?
I didn't know senators were that powerful myself. But, you know, I this is something that's been going on, since, let's say, 2015. And it's the discourse in this country has devolved into a really very disturbing level on all sides. And
on all sides. That,
yes, on all sides.
Emphasize.
And actually, you would argue that there's one person in particular who has really brought this discourse down to a level of just debased, and then that's the president himself. This is not. It's just something that's it's almost predictable. You know, actually at the Tony Awards a couple weeks ago, Robert De Niro used a similar expletive with the president, and there's a lot of frustration on both sides, and it really is kind of concerning to see how quickly our discourse has become so coarse. It's unthinkable that just a few years ago that this kind of discussion we'd be having this kind of discussion right now.
Yeah, it's interesting to me. You know, certainly a lot of Democrats are arguing that, well, Trump probably more than any other elected official is responsible for the culture of hate. Yeah. But you get into this kind of endless whataboutism between the two parties, and there's something to be said for just taking a principled stand. And, you know, Governor Hassan not necessarily worrying about what Trump is or is not saying and just saying, okay, that we understand that's problematic. However, you know, having a young intern tell the president, drop the F-bomb, it's pretty disrespectful. And I don't know that a one-week suspension of your privileges is kind of making a particularly strong statement there. So I think, you know, at some point, there's something to be said for, yes, acknowledging that that it's bigger than just this one individual. But you got to start somewhere in taking a stand on this stuff. And, you know, I think it's just going to keep spiraling downward if somebody at some point doesn't draw a line. And I think Senator Hassan had an opportunity to do that, and she decided for whatever reason and, you know, not to do that.
Yeah, I mean, the target of what she said, of the person she was addressing at, is not the point. The point is that she said this in the middle of the Capitol building, in the nation's capital. You know, what kind
and
of thought?
She's working for a member of
Congress.
What
kind of thought process is that to say that? Yeah. Oh, yeah, I'm going to do that. I mean, this is what's happened.
And there's something to be said for separating the individual from the institution of the presidency, mm-hmm. and not disrespecting the institution, even if you really dislike
if the person himself sitting in the presidency disrespects.
Yeah. I think it was a missed opportunity, but you know that was her call.
Yeah. Paul, did you want to weigh in?
Yeah, there's a bigger political picture here. I mean, listen, President Trump has been criticized by Democrats ever since he was on the campaign trail for his horrible language. I mean, including the stuff on that Access Hollywood tape, which was just utterly disgraceful. But this incident came not in a vacuum. It came just around the same time that Maxine Waters, the Democratic congresswoman from California, urged her supporters to, you know, take action, maybe even physical action against the president and people who work for him. It came as Sarah Sanders, the White House press secretary, was booted out of a restaurant because she worked for the president. The Homeland Security Secretary Nielsen was booed as she was at a Mexican restaurant. So it's giving ammunition to the president and to the Republicans to try to turn the tables on this argument. And I think that's unfortunate for the Democrats because, you know, they were trying to make this case. Now the tables are being turned.
Yeah, I think there's the part of that is born of frustration, the kind of tactics of showing up and trying to shame people. I think that's born of frustration in the Democratic Party. The party's got a lot of intra-party disagreement now about the future of the party. There's no one clear leader that they believe can go toe-to-toe with President Trump, and that's causing frustration. Mm-hmm. I think it's just the desire to strike back in some way. But you have to think about, you know, what kind of role model do you want to be, and what kind of signals do you want to you ascend? And I think Annie Custer, if I'm correct, was actually critical of the Waters approach to this.
That she drew a lot of criticism, actually, Congresswoman Waters. But the thing I want to say is that it would be refreshing if someone on the Republican side would actually say something about when the president tweets. It is pretty much every day. And actually, the other day it seemed like a minor thing, but he was tweeting about the Congressman Joe Crowley in New York, who was trounced in his primary in Queens, and he just gratuitously called him slovenly Joe Crowley. I mean, why? Why is that something that's acceptable that we can say that the president go between calling somebody slovenly, which he's not, by the way, and it's just why isn't someone calling him out on that?
Well, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR, speaking with Jeff Feingold of New Hampshire Business Review, political reporter Paul Steinhauser, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. We're broadcasting a live video of today's radio show. Check it out, our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. Coming up, we're going to be talking about Steve Marchand's policy to create a sanctuary state here in New Hampshire. What do you think about that? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We're going to take some of your calls and emails as well. Thank you very much for holding on through the break. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
Start spreading the news. We're giving away a trip to New York in a couple of days. If you've been looking to melt away those small town blues, get yourself entered to win a trip to the city so nice they named it twice. All you have to do is contribute to NHPR, your trusted source for state, national, and international news. We're giving away this trip on Saturday, so if you want to be a part of it, don't wait. Give today as generously as you can at nhpr.org.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, political reporter Paul Steinhauser, and Jeff Feingold of New Hampshire Business Review. And with you, give us a call to join the conversation. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. We're going to be talking about gubernatorial candidate Steve Marchand's plan to make a sanctuary state out of New Hampshire. But first, I want to just bring into the conversation a couple of comments from listeners who were listening to the earlier part of the show having to do with Supreme Court decisions. This one regarding the Supreme Court's upholding of the president's ban on travel from several Muslim-majority countries. Gary wrote in to say, regarding the decision to uphold Mr. Trump's Muslim ban, the Supreme Court did not take into consideration the president's biased rhetoric. Yet the case of the baker who refused to serve a gay couple, the court ruled the state of Colorado's investigative board's religious animus was indicative of bias. Correct me if I'm wrong, but what's the difference, Gary writes. Why should intent in one case not be assessed with the same as the other? Is the Supreme Court biased? Seems like the Supreme Court can bring their opinions into these things. That's why we have nine justices, right? Right, Dean?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the issue with the travel ban, there was, you know, part of the dissent was the issue of whether or not Trump's language was a sign of implicit bias targeting a specific religion.
Yeah. We also had a comment from Barbara, who wrote in, I'm deeply disappointed in the SCOTUS decision. I encourage people to hear the stories of real people trying to come here. Barbara writes, I attended an event of the International Institute in Manchester and heard the stories of those who are here. They have endured unbearable hardship. Many are separated from their families and are now, because of the ban, facing the likelihood they will not be reunited. She wrote in to say, these people are not terrorists. I hope our hearts will guide our decisions, not our fears. I hope people will dig deeply into true stories and not react to rhetoric and sound bites. That's the comment from Barbara. Thanks very much. If you have comments or questions, give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Okay, on to Steve Marchand. We've been promising this discussion is coming up, so here it is. Sanctuary state. Gubernatorial candidate Steve Marchand wants to make New Hampshire a sanctuary state, which means local law enforcement wouldn't be sort of deputized to ask someone about their immigration status or detain them. They wouldn't assist ICE in arrests based on civil immigration warrants, wouldn't hold someone in jail past their release date as ICE requests. Paul, this is a move that might get Steve Marchand a lot of attention. Is this likely to get him good attention in the Democratic Party?
Yeah. I mean, this is an issue right now because of what's been going on at the southern border. The timing here was pretty obvious, you know, play off the big news. And it's an issue that resonates, obviously, with the base of the Democratic Party nationally. And here, two of the other things, allowing undocumented immigrants to have access to driver's license and also in-state tuition for the children of some of these undocumented immigrants. Marchand, I was at the event along with Josh Rogers, your top political correspondent here at NHPR. It was held on the west side of Manchester, where Marchand grew up. Remember, he's the child of immigrants, came from Canada, from Quebec.
And he was speaking in front of a statue of a French-Canadian journalist, right?
Right, from the 1800s here in Manchester, when that community was in a tough way. They were not treated so well. So, yeah, and he talked about coming back to the place where he grew up, which was full of a history of immigration. And he was, you know, this was, I think, definitely an attempt to try to play off the news. I spoke to Governor Sununu about this, and he said, no, these are left-wing, extreme left-wing ideas that are infiltrating our state. So it's definitely something I think it's a win for both sides. It's a win for Marchand, who's trying to energize voters and win a pretty tough contest right now with Molly Kelly for the Democratic nomination. But it also gives ammunition to the Republicans to say, this is an extreme left-wing idea. You do not want a Democrat in the corner office.
Yeah, and, you know, I think, you know, Steve is trying to position himself increasingly as a progressive to try to maybe recapture some of the Bernie Sanders Sanders energy from 2016. Molly Kelly very quickly lined up most of the Democratic institutional elites in the state within a matter of weeks of announcing her candidacy. She's raised more money. So it may play well in the primary. This is one of those issues that just gets conservatives exercised, and this is going to be a twofer. They're going to argue, one, as was the case with the San Francisco sanctuary city debate, it will potentially shelter people who are very dangerous, and two, because of the driver's licenses and the reduced tuition, it's allowing undocumented individuals who shouldn't be here to partake of the benefits of being in the United States. So that's the argument you're going to hear, security and resources arguments. You know, conservatives love this kind of stuff in a general election.
It's the kind of issue that will get you attention in the Democratic primary, but yeah. I don't think it's going to get any traction at all in a general election, and I think that's going to be probably an argument that Molly Kelly will make. I mean, I know that what I think we've seen is that Steve Marchand is trying to get some more traction back. He'd been the only one in the race until just a couple months ago, and he seemed to be sailing along there because no one else wanted to challenge him for the Democratic nomination, and Molly Kelly came in there, and now he's got some competition, and he was trying to really figure out what to do. And his decision is to just go further left, and it worked for Bernie Sanders as Dean said, and you know it also worked in New York just the other day with a congressional candidate. Whether New Hampshire's Democratic Party voters will go for it or not remains to be seen. But I know that if it's in a general election, it would be a very difficult sell.
You know, as I pointed out in an article in the Concord Monitor last week, you know, New Hampshire is over 2,000 miles from the U.S.-Mexican border. But immigration is an issue that is very much resonating here, not only because we just, you know, obviously we see the national news all the time. But remember, we are a border state. We have these checkpoints right now by ICE, which basically cover all of New Hampshire. So this is definitely an issue that's resonating here. And both Kelly and Marchand were quick to criticize Governor Sununu on immigration for basically not fighting or pushing back strongly enough against with the federal government for these checkpoints. So it's an issue that's going to continue to be one of the leading issues in this race going straight to November.
Well, another one of the issues about immigration that is important in New Hampshire is that, and Steve Marchand was pointing this out by going to the west side and in Manchester, because, you know, this state is filled with descendants of immigrants, especially the cities, and especially Manchester. If you go to the Mill Yard, there were people from all walks of life, French Canadians, there were people from, they were Irish, they were, you know, just go Greek, all people from all across the world who came to Manchester to work and to other mills to work and settled here in the United States, in New Hampshire, and that's something that I think he's trying to drive home, is that this is not just people who came off the Mayflower the people from the Mayflower are immigrants too. Mm-hmm. But you know, this is a state in particular that has relied a lot on immigrants to just in becoming what the state has become today.
And can I ask really quickly, are there other states that are considered sanctuary states?
Yeah, and he was pointing out that some of these policies that he is proposing are already in practice in other states. And even he mentioned some red states like a Texas, like an Idaho, that actually have allowances for some of the things he's proposing. It's also a workforce development issue. At a time where this state, a silver tsunami is sweeping over New Hampshire, at a time where we're having trouble getting workers into this state, especially younger workers, he and other Democrats are trying to frame this in a way as a workforce development issue. Don't keep them out. Bring them in. Let them come to school here. Let them work here. That's another way he's trying to frame it.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. Just really quickly wanted to return to the topic we were discussing right before the break, having to do with the quality of our political discourse. Of course, prompted by the news that a senator working for, or rather an intern working for Senator Maggie Hassan, shouted an expletive at the president. This woman wrote in, Catherine is her name. Catherine wrote, I just caught part of your discussion of the deterioration of our public discourse in the context of how Senator Hassan should have handled the intern who swore at the president. Just as an aside, the Senator Hassan did not fire this intern, but reprimanded this intern. I agree that those who criticize Trump for his vulgarity should do better themselves. And yes, we should start somewhere, Catherine writes. But I don't agree that we should start with that intern. What message does it send to start with someone at the bottom of the power pyramid? To me, that suggests that might makes right. If we want to make things better, the top leaders like the president of the United States would have to lead the way. That's the comment from Catherine. Thank you very much for weighing in. If you've got comments about any of the stories we discussed, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Before we end the show today, really quickly, since we were talking about Steve Marchand and Molly Kelly, how's the fundraising for them going? Paul?
Marchand is trailing Kelly when it comes to fundraising. Remember, he's been in this race a lot longer, but she's got a lot more money. He's only got about $26,000 cash on hand. She's got about $300,000 cash on hand, which means available to spend. That's important. Remember, that kind of money can help with grassroots outreach. It can help with get-out-the-vote efforts, and it can help by putting ads up on television and on radio. I asked him about the deficit, and he was not. He pushed back saying, listen, I've already spent a lot of money out there already bringing voters in. So he was trying to downplay the deficit, but it is a big one. He also argued that, listen, she's getting a lot of her money from out of state. I'm getting almost all of my money from in-state. That's a fight we're also seeing in the first district congressional race.
Yeah, what about number of voters, or donors, I should say?
He's got an advantage on that as well, which he touted. But remember, she's catching up. She's only been in the race for about 3 months now. He's been in the race for 14 months. It's going to be an interesting primary going down the road here.
Okay. Well, as we look forward to another eventful week of news, what will you be covering? I'll start with you, Jeff. What's going to be on your agenda next week?
Well, after we're figuring out what we're going to have on July 4th, what are we going to grill? But
that is the important question.
No, actually, we're keeping a close eye on these tariffs and how they're affecting New Hampshire businesses because we keep track of what businesses may be in New Hampshire that are filing appeals to get exceptions to these things. And apparently they look like there's a couple of New Hampshire businesses that are doing that. And we're going to keep track of that stuff.
Paul?
I'll start with this weekend. I've got Molly Kelly and Steve Marchand together for the first time on the same stage. They're in a forum in Plymouth. I'll be covering it for the Associated Press, so you'll see my story in a bunch of the newspapers.
Great. And Dean, what will you be watching?
I've talked about it before. July 4th, the official politician kickoff of the summer campaign season. They're going to be out there in the middle of our first heat wave, I think, of the summer, marching, shaking hands, trying to get some momentum leading into the fall primary. So summer is a great political season if you look for it.
Great. And on All Things Considered tonight, we're launching our series, NHPR Summer Music Series, where we're talking to New Hampshire bands and hearing their music. And we're also seeing what kind of venues are out there, which really sort of encapsulate New Hampshire's music scene. If you know of a band or musician or place where music happens regularly that you think we should profile, send us a note. News@nhpr.org is the email address. News@nhpr.org. That's it for today. I want to thank our panel of esteemed reporters and analysts, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and the author of the website NH Political Capital, political reporter Paul Steinhauser, and Jeff Feingold of New Hampshire Business Review. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for being here this
great
hour.
Great to be here. Hey, have a great
thanks,
holiday,
Peter.
Too.
Thanks, Peter.
Hey, thanks, you too. And remember, listeners, you can find links to all the stories that we discussed today at our website, nhpr.org. And the conversation continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and our intern is Abigail Sleeper. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.